You know that feeling when you're standing in the middle of a massive, just incredibly chaotic city intersection?
Oh yeah, just total sensory overload.
Right. Pedestrians are jaywalking everywhere. The traffic lights seem completely unsynchronized. And there's like a street vendor yelling over the noise of a construction crew. To the average person just trying to cross the street, it looks like pure, unpredictable noise.
Yeah, your brain just isn't wired to process that many independent variables operating at once, so it defaults to perceiving it all as randomness. You're just trying to survive the crosswalk.
Exactly. But to a civil engineer or an urban planner, that intersection isn't random at all. They see the underlying traffic patterns. They see the zoning laws that designated that corner for commercial use, which is why the vendor is there.
Right. They see the electrical grid running the lights. And, you know, they probably understand the municipal budget shortfall that explains why the potholes haven't been fixed in 6 months.
Right. They see the system. They have the blueprint for the chaos.
They understand the hidden architecture determining why the friction is happening in that specific location at that specific time.
And that blueprint is exactly what we're trying to construct for you in today's deep dive. We have a massive, highly ambitious 2026 report to look at today. It's called The Comprehensive Guide to Political Science.
It is a dense one, yeah.
Very dense. But our mission today is to distill this complex document into a master key for you. The goal is to provide you, the listener, with a mental map to decode everything from the latest, you know, zoning argument at your local city council meeting all the way up to major international geopolitical crises.
Because this guide really takes a step back from the daily news cycle. It frames political science not just as the study of government buildings or election polling, but as a family of overlapping research programs.
Right.
And despite their differences, all these programs revolve around one recurring mechanism, which is how human communities make binding collective decisions.
Okay, let's unpack this. The report clarifies early on that political science isn't just analyzing the state. It is the systematic study of power.
Yes.
The guide takes us back to the etymology to really anchor this. The discipline comes from the Greek word polis, meaning city or community, and the Latin word scientia, meaning knowledge. So it's basically the knowledge of how a community operates.
Exactly. And to analyze this, the guide provides three foundational definitions that distinguish between power, authority, and legitimacy. Separating those three concepts is really the prerequisite for making sense of any political reality.
Let's break those down.
Sure. So the text defines power simply as the capacity to shape decisions and behavior. It is raw capability. Authority, though, is fundamentally different.
Because authority is when that power is regarded as rightful,
right?
Or formally institutionally authorized.
Precisely. And finally, legitimacy is the belief or the normative judgment held by the population that the rulers actually have a justified right to hold that authority.
So, to go back to our city intersection, if we imagine society as a house, power is the raw electricity. It's just force running through the wires, capable of doing work or doing damage.
I like that.
Right. And authority is the physical wiring and the circuit breakers that dictate where that electricity is officially supposed to go.
And legitimacy would be the building inspector's stamp on the electrical panel.
Exactly. It is the trust that stops the homeowners from ripping the walls down.
Yeah.
Because they actually believe the system was built correctly and safely.
That analogy perfectly highlights the vulnerability of the system, actually. A state can possess the electricity, the raw coercive power of a military or a police force, without having the inspector's stamp of legitimacy.
But doing that is expensive, right?
Incredibly expensive. As the guide points out, relying on raw power without legitimacy requires enormous resources. It is highly unstable over a long timeline because compliance has to be constantly forced rather than volunteered.
But wait, if legitimacy is ultimately defined in the text as a belief or a normative judgment, I want to push back on the scope of what we're talking about here.
Okay, go ahead.
Does that mean political science is essentially just a macro version of collective psychology? I mean, if a government's survival rests entirely on what people believe is justified, it sounds like we're just analyzing human emotion and persuasion.
What's fascinating here is that you've identified the exact core tension that forces political science to be so interdisciplinary. The guide explicitly states that the discipline is simultaneously interpretive, causal, and normative.
So it's pulling from everywhere.
Right. It fuses psychology with economics and sociology.
Yeah.
Consider concepts highlighted in the text, like affective polarization.
Oh, we should define that for the listener. Affective polarization isn't just, like, disagreeing on a tax policy, right?
Correct. Affective polarization is a psychological phenomenon where individuals feel active, intense hostility toward an opposing group, regardless of the actual policies being debated.
It's just pure tribalism.
Exactly. It's driven by tribal identity rather than rational calculation. Political scientists also study motivated reasoning, which is the psychological tendency to twist incoming facts to fit a pre-existing belief.
Yeah, we see that all the time.
You cannot analyze a modern election without understanding those psychological mechanisms, but, and this is key, you also cannot ignore the economic incentives like inflation or job markets that trigger those psychological responses in the first place. The discipline requires analyzing the whole board.
So if the underlying reality of power involves both the hardwiring of institutions and the complex psychology of the people living inside them, academics clearly need entirely different toolkits to study different parts of the grid.
They absolutely do.
And that transition really explains how this report maps out the boundaries of the discipline itself.
Yeah, the report identifies 31 distinct subfields within political science, but the primary dividing line is the tension between normative study and empirical study.
Right. On the normative side, the text outlines political philosophy. It points to canonical thinkers like Plato or modern philosophers like John Rawls.
And they aren't looking at data sets.
Exactly. This field isn't looking at data sets of voter turnout. It asks the structural, moral questions. What should justice look like? What ought to be considered a legitimate use of force by a state?
Whereas empirical political science asks what actually exists in reality, why it occurs, and what the measurable consequences are. And within that empirical side, the traditional architecture of the discipline splits into two major pillars.
Comparative politics and international relations. Let's define the difference for everyone.
Sure. Comparative politics generally looks within domestic systems to isolate variables and explain why regimes differ.
So comparing two countries side by side.
Right. A comparativist looks at two neighboring nations with similar economies and asks, why did country A consolidate into a stable democracy while country B collapsed into a military dictatorship?
And then international relations is the opposite.
Right. International relations, commonly called IR, looks across borders. It views the global arena as an anarchic system, meaning there's no global police force to enforce rules, and studies how states navigate alliances, trade, and war in that environment.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Reading through those definitions, those academic silos seem a bit, well, artificial for the modern world.
How so?
Let's look at a hypothetical scenario. A civil war starts locally over an ethnic cleavage. That's a classic comparative politics problem, right?
Traditionally, yes.
But almost immediately, that local conflict draws in international superpowers funding proxy armies, and it disrupts global economic supply chains for a critical mineral. At that point, isn't the line between comparative politics and international relations completely imaginary?
It's not imaginary, but it is a matter of scope and variables. If researchers don't separate them initially, the data becomes way too noisy to analyze.
Oh, interesting. So it's just about managing the data.
Yeah, you have to isolate the domestic rules from the international pressures before you can figure out how they actually interact. If you try to study the global supply chain disruption and the local ethnic history simultaneously without distinct frameworks, you just end up with correlations that don't prove causation.
So the boundary exists to keep the data clean, but the reality is obviously much messier.
Exactly. And the reality of that messy overlap is why the guide highlights bridging subfields. It specifically lists foreign policy analysis and political geography.
Right. Those sit right in the middle.
Yeah. These exist purely to connect domestic institutional choices to international structural pressures. Foreign policy analysis, for instance, studies how a leader's domestic political vulnerabilities, say, facing a really tough re-election campaign, cause them to make aggressive maneuvers on the international stage.
Okay, so if the boundaries of what researchers are studying are fluid, the guide pivots to something even more critical, which is how scholars look at the exact same problem using entirely different theoretical lenses. This is part 3 of the text.
This is where the discipline really demonstrates its analytical depth.
Yeah.
The guide uses the example of democratic backsliding, which it identifies as a dominant research focus from 2024 to 2026.
And we should clarify, backsliding is not a sudden military coup.
No, not at all. It is the gradual legalistic erosion of democratic norms, electoral fairness, and institutional checks and balances. It's a single complex crisis, but scholars dissect it using entirely different analytical toolkits.
Let's walk through these four lenses because this completely changes how you read the news.
Let's do it.
If you're an institutionalist studying backsliding, you are looking at the formal rules of the game. You're examining constitutional limits, the separation of powers, and what the text calls veto points.
Right. A veto point is essentially a toll booth on a legislative highway. It's any institutional mechanism where an actor can stop a policy from moving forward, like a presidential veto, a Supreme Court ruling, or a filibuster.
So an institutionalist just wants to know if those toll booths are malfunctioning or being bypassed entirely. But if you use the behavioralist lens, you don't care about the toll booths at all. You are looking at the drivers.
Yes, you study voter tolerance for norm violations.
Right. You measure whether citizens have become so gripped by that effective polarization we talked about earlier that they'll forgive their own leaders for breaking democratic rules simply to prevent the opposing party from winning.
Then there's the rational choice scholar. They approach the crisis almost mathematically. They model the strategic, calculated incentives of the incumbents.
They just assume everyone is selfish.
Pretty much. They assume political actors are self-interested utility maximizers. They calculate the cost-benefit analysis for a politician considering an anti-democratic action.
So if the political reward of gerrymandering a district heavily outweighs the risk of being punished by voters, the rational choice model predicts the politician will gerrymander the district.
Exactly. It's a calculation.
Finally, we have the elite theorist. This lens argues that the average voter's behavior or the formal constitutional rules don't matter nearly as much as who controls the capital.
Right, the money and the influence.
Yeah, they examine how organized, wealthy minorities capture the media landscape, the financial institutions, and the courts to consolidate power quietly, right behind the facade of a functioning democracy.
So you see, each approach isolates a distinct active mechanism driving the exact same crisis.
It sounds like diagnosing a complex illness in a hospital. Like a cardiologist looks at the plumbing and the blood flow. A neurologist looks at the electrical signals in the brain. An epidemiologist looks at the environmental factors that caused the illness in the first place.
That's a great comparison.
None of them are wrong. But a hospital needs all of those specialists consulting together to save a patient with multiple failing organs. So, does political science operate that way in reality, or do these scholars just argue with each other in academic journals?
This raises an important question about how knowledge is actually built in the social sciences. The text argues that a mature research design deliberately integrates these approaches.
Okay.
The report features a diagram, figure 2, mapping out research methods with a really strong emphasis on mixed methods.
How does a mixed methods approach actually work on the ground?
It means combining the wide lens with the microscope. To truly understand backsliding, a researcher might start with a massive cross-national statistical analysis to find broad patterns.
Like proving that countries with high inflation are 30% more likely to experience democratic erosion.
Exactly. But statistics only show correlation. To prove causation, they combine that data with qualitative methods like process tracing.
Process tracing is a term that gets thrown around a lot in academic literature. What does a researcher actually do when they are process tracing?
They essentially act like an investigative detective. Instead of just looking at the before and after of a political event, they track the exact chronological footprint of how a decision was made.
Digging through the archives.
Right. They dig into declassified memos, interview key advisors, and reconstruct the timeline day by day. They want to see the specific moment the cost-benefit analysis shifted in a leader's mind.
Ah, I see. You need the statistical analysis to prove the trend exists, but you absolutely need the process tracing to explain the human mechanism behind it.
And applying all these diverse lenses and mixed methods is critical, especially when the discipline is forced to confront completely unprecedented developments.
Which brings us to the mid-2020s research frontier mapped out in the report.
Yes. The politics of technology, digital politics, and AI governance.
The guide details how technological systems are fundamentally reshaping the foundational definition of power we talked about earlier.
It's a paradigm shift. The capacity to shape decisions and behavior is increasingly residing in digital infrastructures and the private companies that own them.
The 2025 and 2026 research notes in the text point to a rapid evolution. We're looking at algorithmic amplification, where software decides which political messages actually gain traction.
And we are looking at synthetic media and deepfakes altering the factual baseline of reality itself. The text highlights a 2025 book, Rewiring Democracy, by Bruce Schneier and Nathan Sanders, which really tackles how automated decision-making is penetrating state bureaucracies.
One of the most critical concepts the report introduces here is the geopolitical concentration of compute.
Let's define compute for a second, because we aren't just talking about a group of smart software engineers writing code in a garage in Silicon Valley.
No, not at all. Compute refers to the massive physical infrastructure required to train and run advanced artificial intelligence models.
We're talking about hyperscale data centers.
Hyperscale data centers, the massive energy grids required to cool them, and the highly vulnerable global supply chains for advanced microchips. The capability to build frontier AI is not distributed evenly.
Not even close.
It is concentrated in the hands of a very few multinational corporations and the states that host them.
The guide references a classic political geography scholar named Halford Mackinder, who wrote about the geographical pivot of history. Historically, geopolitics meant studying who controlled strategic choke points, right? Like the oceans, the oil fields, or key land masses.
Exactly.
But now the pivot of history is compute governance. Who controls the data centers? So based on the definitions of power and authority we established in Section 1, are these massive tech companies essentially operating as sovereign states?
That's a fair question.
I mean, are they regulating transnational problems without any democratic accountability?
That observation strikes at the heart of the current research frontier. In the sections covering global governance and international political economy, the report explains how private governance and platform power are forcing political science to redefine what an institution even is.
Because traditionally, an institution is a parliament or a court.
Right. But if a social media platform's recommendation algorithm dictates what information millions of voters see before an election, that algorithm is functioning as a political institution.
Wow. Yeah, it distributes resources, in this case, attention and information.
And it exercises coercive power over public discourse.
But it completely lacks the building inspector's stamp of legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
There's no transparency into how the algorithm works, and the public didn't vote for the engineers who wrote it. It is just the raw electricity of power operating outside the traditional wiring of authority.
Which is exactly why the discipline is urgently trying to apply those four analytical lenses, institutionalist, behavioral, rational choice, and elite theory, to tech companies.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, researchers are trying to map the incentives of AI CEOs the exact same way they map the incentives of heads of state.
You know, the comforting part of this massive deep dive is realizing that whether we're analyzing an ancient Roman emperor hoarding grain to control the populace, or a modern tech executive hoarding compute to control an AI market, the underlying mechanics of how power flows follow a recognizable, predictable path.
They really do. And the report synthesizes the vast complexity of the entire discipline into what it calls the unified sequence of political science questions.
That's figure 3 of the text, right?
Yes, figure 3. It is a 6-step sequence that links everything we have discussed today, creating a causal chain from the initial distribution of resources all the way up to global stability.
Let's run through this 6-step sequence quickly. Step 1 asks, who has power? This requires looking at the raw distribution of resources, class structures, and demographic organization. It's assessing the playing field.
Step 2 asks, how is that power acquired or maintained? This is the mechanism phase. Are they using democratic elections, psychological persuasion, or outright military coercion?
Step 3 asks, which institutions organize this power?
This is where the institutionalist lens comes in. You map out the constitutions, the court systems, and the formal rules that attempt to cage and direct the power.
Step 4 asks, how do actors behave within those institutional rules?
And this is where the behavioral and rational choice lenses apply. You examine the psychology of the voters and the strategic, calculated incentives of the politicians.
Step 5 looks at the output. How is policy actually made? This isn't just campaign promises. This is examining the budgeting process, the bureaucratic implementation, and the feedback loops. Who actually gets the money and who pays the taxes?
Finally, step 6 zooms all the way out. How does all of this domestic friction meet the world order, and how does it affect systemic stability?
Does a domestic economic crisis lead to an aggressive international war? Or does the domestic system adapt, reform, and endure?
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? why should you care about a six-step academic framework?
Well, because this sequence is essentially a master cheat sheet for consuming reality.
It really is.
When you scroll through the daily news, it feels like that chaotic city intersection we started with. You see a headline about a federal interest rate hike, followed by a story about a local zoning protest over housing, followed by an article about a new European tech regulation on algorithms. It feels incredibly disjointed and overwhelming.
But if you take any one of those stories and map it onto this sequence, the hidden architecture reveals itself.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it fundamentally transforms how you consume information. You stop seeing isolated random events and you start seeing the causal mechanisms of power.
Take the local zoning protest. You immediately recognize it as a step one and step five issue.
Right. It's a struggle over who has the resources to build and a reaction to how municipal policy is implemented.
You identify exactly where the friction is happening in the sequence.
The report concludes with a vital reminder about the purpose of the discipline. Political science is at its strongest when it exposes the cold, hard mechanics of power while never losing sight of the human consequences.
Right.
Analyzing veto points and algorithms is meaningless unless it actually helps us understand legitimacy, human freedom, and accountability.
We want to thank you for joining us on this exploration of the architecture of modern political science. Our hope is that this mental map from understanding power and legitimacy to applying the six-step sequence makes the world feel a little less random and a lot more decipherable.
The next time you are overwhelmed by a chaotic news cycle, remember the sequence and look for the blueprint.
But before we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought that builds on everything we just explored. The source material explicitly defines political science as the study of how human communities make collective decisions.
Human being, the key word there.
Exactly. It is deeply rooted in our psychology, our economic needs, and our human behavior. But as we discussed with the new frontier of AI governance, we're increasingly handing more and more binding authority over to automated systems and algorithms. If the systems allocating our financial resources, curating our political reality, and ultimately writing our policies are no longer human, will the political science of the 21st century still be studying the behavior of people? Or will it be forced to study the behavior of machines? The next time you are standing at that chaotic city intersection, look up at the traffic light controlling the flow of power and ask yourself, who is actually in control of the grid?